Hi. I want to start out today's show by reading the first couple paragraphs of a blog entry that was sent to me by my friend and friend of the show, Howie, down in Connecticut. Or that's where he was last I knew. He was one of the organizers of Students for Liberty at UConn. And you might remember I went down to speak there and had a grand time doing that. And I would love to go back. And another thanks to Howie, because he sent this to me, and I actually got a pretty decent show out of it, I think. But Howie was not the author of this blog, by the way. In fact, when he posted it on my Facebook page, he said, one of my friends posted this in my newsfeed saying it was an interesting article. It filled me with rage. I don't know how one responds to an entry like this in a calm, respectful way. Well, I'm working on doing stuff in calm and respectful ways, so I'm going to give that a try. But here's the first two paragraphs. The title is Education Reform, Can We Blame the Students? From Wednesday, March 2nd, 2011. With the protests in Wisconsin still front page news, there has been a great deal of discussion about education reform. I've heard a lot of discussion about teachers' unions and that these organizations make it impossible to fire bad teachers, and that this ability to not rout out bad teachers and conversely reward good teachers is one of the major reasons our schools are failing our students. Now, I agree, like any profession, there are ineffectual teachers that are hurting the school system. However, in my experience, that population is rather small. Most teachers are passionate about their profession and the students they teach. My belief is that the last person to blame for poor test scores in the United States are teachers. However, there is one group of people that are never mentioned as a problem in our failing school system, and that's the students. I will talk to the person who wrote this blog and read the rest of it on the show today. He is a college professor from Washington State University, and this actually went pretty well. Thanks for listening, and take care.
First thing I remember knowing was a lonesome whistle blow. Freight train leaving town, not knowing where I've bound. No one could change my mind, but Mama tried. One and only rebel child from a family meek and mild. Mama seemed to know what lay in store. In spite of all my Sunday learning, for the bad I kept on turning.
Hello, Alex.
Yes, Brett.
Yeah, how are you?
Good, how are you?
I'm doing good. So, listen, I'll leave this up to you as far as how much you want to reveal. Do you want to use your whole name? Do you just want to use Alex? Do you want to talk about what you do, where you work? What do you think?
You know, I'm happy to give my whole name and where I work and what I do.
I'm going to shoot for like a half an hour here, so I'm cool with just getting started if you want to
sure.
Talk a little bit about who you are.
Yeah. Well, my name's Alex Sternfeld-Dunn, and right now I'm a professor at Washington State University in Pullman, Washington, and I teach in the School of Music. I actually got all my training in music, and you know, and so I'm a composer mostly. And at Washington State, I teach music theory and music composition.
Cool. So it looks like this blog post that we're going to talk about was kind of inspired maybe by the Wisconsin situation. How did your ears perk up, I guess, to this?
Yeah, I mean, it yes and no. I think the Wisconsin situation probably sorry, I'm stumbling here. Yeah, I think that sort of made me want to write about it. You know, I have always sort of felt in the last couple of years especially that I have a certain frustration sometimes with my students, especially because I teach higher education where, you know, this is the first time most of these students get to, you know, be adults. And so they make adult decisions and they have adult consequences. And that means a lot of times they don't come to class. They, when they are in class, they, you know, text message or they get on the computer and hang out on Facebook and all of those things. And the thing that was bugging me about the Wisconsin conversation, and I think, you know, the situation with Wisconsin is a difficult one that can't be, I don't know that it can really be easily summarized, but the thing that I kept hearing was, well, you know, we've got this problem. There's so many bad teachers, And I just never felt like, well, what about the bad students? You know, and as they're discussing, well, you know, we need to look at, we need to reward the good teachers, and we need to make sure we can get rid of the bad teachers, and we need to be able to evaluate that. Well, you know, and I've heard that from both sides, you know, Democrats, Republicans have both talked about this evaluation process. And I think it's, well, on the surface, it sounds like a good idea. How do you really do that evaluation? I mean, do you do it through testing? Well, what if you've got a classroom that doesn't have, you know, has four or five students who just couldn't care less, no matter how great a teacher you are? Maybe you've got two students who have major test anxiety. So you know, you can't do it that way. What about grades? Well, what if you've got students who just don't want to do their homework? You know, does the teacher get punished for that? And then that doesn't even take care of the things that aren't as tangible. For instance, what about special education teachers? You know, how do they get evaluated? Or the music teachers or the drama teachers, you know, how do they get evaluated?
Yeah, you know, so, I think, well, if I can just stop you right there, it's a good point, because when we're stuck in this mess and all of this confusion of the public system, it's a very valid question of how do things get evaluated. You know, in the market, we know how things get evaluated from consumer feedback. Like, I run a tutoring company. That business is built by word of mouth. If I'm not good, past clients evaluate me as far as future business is concerned. Private schools get evaluated by enrollment. You know, so there are real authentic market forces that evaluate things that exist in the market. Of course, when we go into the public sector, yeah, it really just becomes all of these arbitrary bean counting rituals to try and quantify quality. So it's, yeah, it's a great question. It really can't happen. And, before we go any further, I just want to say this is not live. So if, you know, if at any point you say strike that, I want to say that again, you can pause. Don't worry about that. I'll clean this up. I'll make us both sound like pros. That's my secret. That's my secret. So,
fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good initial point right there, is that it's really difficult to evaluate people in the public sector, but the unions trying to have a level playing field as far as, like, let's treat everybody the same. Don't you think that's a little bit permissive as far as, like, letting maybe good or competent or effective teachers drag along a bunch of bad people? And that doesn't that incentivize more unmotivated and incompetent people to go into that field, where they say, oh, well, if the union will protect me and everybody else will just kind of drag me along? I'm not saying that that happens all the time in public education, but don't you think that that possibility exists when you look at that kind of incentive structure?
You know, I would say that that possibility, sure, it's a possibility that it could exist. I don't think it really exists in this current system right now, mostly because I feel that the teaching itself is, you know, the people who go into teaching tend to go into teaching because they have a love for teaching.
Agreed.
And you certainly don't, you know, you don't do it for the money. I think there's this misnomer that goes out there. Well, you know, it's a part-time job. You know, they work 9 months out of the year and they're done at 3 o'clock. And, you know, that's a fallacy. I mean, yes, you're done teaching at 3 o'clock, but then you got to go home. You got to grade papers. You got to prepare lectures. And then on top of that, you don't really get 3 months off. You know, most teachers have a 9-month contract and they just spread their paycheck over 12 months. So I think that's another fallacy about that. So I think, to get back to your original question, I mean, there is this possibility, I think, but I think I actually think the percentage of bad teachers who are going into, I would say that was true if we were talking about positions where you come in and you start as a teacher as $120,000 and say, well, I'm going to make some easy money. But most teachers, it's not easy money. Even the bad teachers who do, I think, the minimum amount of work, it's still a lot of work. And I think there's easier ways to, to make that kind of money. In my view.
Yeah, and I think that, well, I mean, my experience, I worked on the public school schedule for 2 years of my career. When I taught in private school, I worked less than 1,100 hours a year. and was, you know, effective as a teacher, was planned ahead by months. And that even includes like working in August to get ahead of the game, to have everything planned, to have everything printed, put in folders by the units I wanted to teach, writing my own curriculum for the history classes that I taught. That was 1,100 hours a year. I think it broke down to about 28 hours a week of work. So I think the average compensation package, I think the average salary is somewhere in the mid-50s, just in Wisconsin. And then if you add in all the benefits, including these pensions, we're talking an average in the high 70s, low 80s. Mm-hmm. Now, if you break that down hourly, assuming, like, let's say these people, let's just call them all good teachers who go above and beyond,
sure,
and work 1,500 hours a year, those hourly wages are certainly way, way above average. And I think one of the things that attracts people to public sector work is job security.
Mm-hmm.
People know that it's incredibly difficult to fire incompetent public sector employees, and it seems to be especially true in education because of the power of the NEA, which I think is the largest teachers union in the country. But I mean, I take your point that a majority of the people, if we're talking about individuals, I don't want to make this about picking on the individuals who choose to do this as a profession. It's what I wanted, sure, to do for a profession. I think it has more to do with the system. And when we're dividing it up kind of like in students versus teachers, we're giving the system, the bureaucracy, it's kind of getting a pass, right? It's kind of being left out of the debate. And if you don't mind, I wanted to read what you wrote, and then we can talk about it a little bit. I
think it'll
take me about 2 minutes. All right.
Sure.
With the protests in Wisconsin still front page news, there's been a great deal of discussion about education reform. I've heard a lot of discussion about teachers unions and that these organizations make it impossible to fire bad teachers, and that this ability to not root out bad teachers and conversely reward good teachers is one of the major reasons our schools are failing our students. Now, I will agree, like any profession, there are ineffectual teachers that are hurting the school system. However, in my experience, that population is rather small. Most teachers are passionate about their profession and the students they teach. My belief is that the last person to blame for poor test scores in the U.S. are teachers. However, there is one group of people who are never mentioned as a problem in our failing education system, and that's the students. I believe as a society, we focus our energy telling children about the importance of education, but we don't try to instill a passion for education. While some students go to school with a genuine passion to learn, most treat school like a social event. While it's true that learning how to socialize is an important skill set that you develop at school, it's not why you go to school. The lack of passion became clear to me when I started teaching in higher education. This is the first time students are really given free will to go to class, do their homework, and learn. I'm always surprised at the amount of students who choose not to come to class for a myriad of reasons, none of which are illness. It shocks me how many students don't turn in their homework because they forgot to do it. Some students, not all, just don't care. It comes through every day when a kid texts in class, has a side discussion, doesn't come to class, comes late, etc. They have no passion for learning. So I would say the real causes of bad test scores is so many students don't care about education. It's the students' fault. And that's the end. And anything you want to say first? Because there's actually a part of this that I kind of related to a little bit, but anything you want to add?
Sure. I will say, obviously, I think when you hear the blog, I hope that it comes across that there is a little bit of facetiousness there, in the sense that I'm not just saying, well, you know, the education system sucks and it's the student's fault. Don't blame the teacher.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's the bigger picture is really that I feel like there is a percentage of the student population that isn't excited about learning. And I don't know that I mean, I think that falls on the student's shoulder, but I think it's the bigger issue is what society in America, the way they view education. And whenever you hear someone talk about education, what you hear is the importance of an education. Well, why? So that they can go to college. Well, why? So they can get a job. Well, you know, well, why? So they can make a good living and go on and live, you know, and it's always for this sort of the financial benefit of it. And what I think we never hear is the importance to have a passion for learning, which I think are two very different things. And if we focus more of our attention on getting people excited about learning, then I think that we could see a change in the way that our education system works. That if we could instill, and I think part of that is if you even look who we idolize as a society, you know, Paris Hilton, Kim Kardashian, who are these people? They're famous for doing nothing.
Right, right.
You know, why aren't we, you know, it used to be, you know, think about, you know, back in the 60s, when an astronaut landed on the moon, that was a thing that everybody paid attention to. Everybody was glued in front of their TV set. Everybody admired this astronaut, this person, you know, Buzz Aldrin, who had a PhD from MIT. This was our hero. And now our heroes have changed into people who don't care about learning, or at least, you know, it's not on the surface. It doesn't seem like they do. I could be wrong about Paris Hilton. I don't know her.
People who have, well, you, the idols are the people who have these lives of luxuries and material wealth. And yes. And they flaunt it on television. And of course, this goes into, you know, all of these reality TV shows. You're right. So when you're talking about this absence of passion for learning, and then you say, okay, well, why do you want to get, why do you want to do good in school? So you can go to college. Well, why do you want to go to college? You can get a good job. Well, why do you want a good job? Is it fair to say, like, I don't want to be putting words in your mouth, but our entire lives, and this is really kicked off in our education, becomes about chasing and grabbing these dangling carrots of rewards and avoiding these swinging sticks of punishment. So essentially, everything that is pushing us forward or pushing us to the next step is some kind of extrinsic motivator that we're told is important instead of intrinsic motivators that we decide are important for ourselves.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I would say, I would even say it in maybe an even simpler way, which is, I think that the new cultural importance is how can I make as much money as possible with doing as little work as necessary?
Right.
Yeah. And I think that's, in a way, that's what it boils down to. And it's interesting too. You know, when I was doing my doctorate, one of my professors was a woman who was from Asia. And, you know, every year you do, or at the end of every semester, we do these teacher evaluations where we evaluate the class, we evaluate the teacher. And I give them to my students now. And she said this was such a foreign idea to her that the students would evaluate the teachers. Because in Japan, where she was from, every student felt like the teacher was the master. And what right was it of theirs to tell the teacher what they were doing wrong? Now, I will say from my teacher evaluations that I get, I'm fortunate, I get very positive evaluations. But, you know, they've made some comments that I went, oh, I hadn't thought about that. I'll take that into consideration. But there are certain questions on these evaluations, like, how well does the teacher know this subject? Well, my feeling is, why does this student who's taking this class with me, who has no expertise, why do they get to rate what my expertise is? What do they know?
Well, they, I think that there is a feeling. I don't know if you can have it like when you're in elementary school, you know, like, sure. I don't think an elementary school student could look at their fourth grade teacher and be like, oh boy, this person just really doesn't get the concept of division like I do. But I think by the time you get to college, I remember being in graduate school and saying, this person has no idea what they're talking about. They're making like just to give you an actual example of this.
Sure.
I was in a educational leadership program to become an administrator, a public school administrator. This was 2003, 2004. And the theme of the class was about thinking outside the box and how important it is, which that was just like a popular catchphrase, you know, seven, sure. 8 years ago. And I didn't know much then, but I had student taught. I had spent time in these schools. I had even worked in a private school and saw how bureaucratized certain aspects of that that place were. So I'm thinking, like, you know, being a public school administrator is not about thinking outside the box. It's about filling out paperwork and following procedures and making sure other people follow procedures. Thinking outside the box gets you fired, gets you in trouble with the school board. So, like, I wound up leaving that program. And I think that at some point, you know, a person can say, well, this person could no more. I mean, maybe that was an extreme example. Maybe that person just should not have been teaching at the graduate level. But I think it's a fair question. I take your point that obviously you know more about the subject than they do. Almost always. Now, I think in high school today, where kids could, in a history class, kids could be fact checking their teachers with some kind of smartphone in real sure. time. In the yeah. class. And if you think about how much BS there is in a public school civics or government or history education, a student could at a high school level make a pretty valid argument that the teacher doesn't know what they're talking about.
Yeah, I think it's more. Well, let me just say two things. Number one, I think your story is a fair one. And I think the one thing, though, is I do think that changes once you're in the graduate level, because at the graduate level, you have a certain real life experience to draw from. And there's a, you know, especially when you're talking masters or even doctoral students who, you know, are in a sense almost junior colleagues to faculty members. But I do, you know, an 18-year-old telling me I don't know my subject, I think the better way to think about it is not, does this person know this information, but are they able to communicate this information? And I think that's a fair evaluator. You know, does this person know what he's talking about? And now you're thinking about fact checking. Absolutely. And I think this will hopefully keeps more people honest and making sure that they don't just float by on old facts and old information. And, you know, although I teach the same classes every year, pretty much the same group of classes every year, I always reevaluate my lesson plans before I teach, you know, and that means going back and doing new research and staying up to date in my field. And I, part of that though, really is that you're absolutely right. Students have the technology now to call a professor out right in class.
Right, right.
And I will say this, the best teacher I ever had in high school was actually my American history teacher. And, well, I shouldn't say he was the best. He was one of the best teachers I saw. And what I liked about him was a student would ask him a question. And he was new. He had been teaching 1 or 2 years. And a student would ask him a question. He would say, you know, I'm not sure, but I'll look it up and I'll come back tomorrow and I'll let you know.
Yep. My favorite teacher was actually a college professor. You know, that was he knew. It seemed at the time like he knew everything, you know, about the Civil War. And unfortunately, because he incorporated his political views a lot into his what appeared to be an objective teaching of history, I had to go and relearn some stuff later. But I still sure. credit him as a very important and influential figure in my, you know, educational development. But he would say the same thing, even though he knew so much. He would be, you know, I just don't know, but I'm excited about finding out. And I really like that. And I think, you know, yeah. as far as this evaluation question goes, you're right. It might just be a simple change of language. Like, how well does this person communicate these ideas? Because I think in many cases, the students might not be able to judge the amount of information or the grasp of the subject that a teacher actually has. But right. Communicating the ideas is really what the teaching part is all about. Good leader can't get too far ahead of their followers.
Right.
It seems like this recurring theme with science teachers, and I know this from my own experience in high school, but I deal with this a lot, tutoring students in subjects like physics and chemistry, even right up to this day, where science teachers are great at science and like terrible at teaching. And I remember like being in chemistry as a junior and bringing like a chemical equation up to the teacher and being like, you know, I just can't get this balanced. And he would look at me like, but you dress and feed yourself. You know, but you can't do this. It's just, you know, mind-boggling that I couldn't balance the chemical equation. So he was way too far ahead of his followers and was not very good at communicating the ideas.
There are two things I'd like to say about that.
Yeah.
One is, I think we've hit the nail on the head. When we're talking about bad teachers, when I think of a bad teacher, ultimately it comes down to communication. And that's what, I think almost every teacher who goes into the field of teaching, certainly has a specialty and an expertise in their area. The question is, are they able to communicate it? And the ones that aren't able to communicate it in a effectively are the teachers who I would put under the quote unquote bad teacher umbrella. And then on the other half of that too, I think that the best teachers that I've seen typically are the teachers who the material that they teach now is the material that didn't come, it wasn't just second nature to them. They really had to process that information so that they had to go through the steps to work it out. So when they get students who it doesn't come naturally, they've already been there and done that. I think this is very true, at least in music. The people who the private teachers I see who were just natural virtuosos on their instrument tend to be weaker, private teachers, because they never had to think about how they made that sound. They just made a beautiful sound. So those are, I think, two points I'd like to piggyback on with that story.
Yeah. And that reminds me too of, my friend Howie sent me this blog and that you wrote, and he was kind of like, I found this kind of upsetting. And well, what do you make of it? And, I read it and I was reading the last paragraph, and while I think this problem goes far beyond students, there was something where, you work in higher education, and I remember being a high school teacher where I was working mostly with juniors and seniors. And I do remember this experience, this feeling that I had as a teacher. When you talk about like actually having to go through the steps and really work hard to learn material, I remember in the subject of history, all this work, all this research that I would do and bring it into the class and, have this attitude like, oh, today is just going to be the biggest success. And these kids are going to find this just as fascinating as I do. And, the truth was that I was catching them at the end of what for most of them had been a very negative educational experience, where so much of their attitude about education had already been formed. And, I hate to use kind of crude and, cold analogies, but it was like I was catching them at the end of the assembly line, where all of the production on them has already taken place, and I'm just kind of standing there at the end holding the box that they fall into. And that was really frustrating. So I think it's the same thing or very similar where you're getting them a couple years later and you feel like something has happened, or something is going on that, happened before you could intervene or you could have any influence. And, I don't know. For me, it was kind of like a feeling of powerlessness. And I don't know if it was right for me to want to feel powerful in that situation. I mean, my attitude about education has changed a lot since then, but I really identified with what you were saying there. Cause I remember that feeling. It's like, oh, it's too much damage has been done for even all of these great things that I think I can do, or all of these exciting things. They're just not receptive to this.
Yeah. It's interesting. I have to say my experience in higher education, so right now I teach at a public university. Prior to this, when I was doing my doctorate, I taught at a private university, and I also taught at a junior college. And those, all three of those experiences were all very different. The private college experience though was very fascinating to me because, the price of their education was about $50,000 a year. No, not cheap. And I would get them as freshmen, and I always say, now remember, you're paying, let's say you are lucky enough to get out of here in 4 years, you're paying $200,000 for your education. Now the question is, are you going to get a $200,000 education? Because if you're not going to put forth that effort to do that, well, save that money and buy a house because, that will be more beneficial to you than just treading water for 4 years and blowing 200 grand. I had always hoped that, you know, the thing with higher education that I hoped would be different, and it's interesting how in some ways it's not, is that once you get to college, well, the excitement of the fact that now you get to study the thing that you are most passionate about. You know, yes, you have to take these general education requirements, and that's fine. But the fact that, you know, the students that I'm teaching are the students who are passionate about music. And so this is the subject they're passionate about, and it's still hard to get them to lock in and focus and come to class and, you know, pay attention and do their homework. And what's really interesting to me is how many of my students are incredibly bright and very inquisitive, you know, and ask really fantastic questions, yet they can't wake up at 8:30 to get to a 9 o'clock class on time. That's too hard for them. And so, you know, I think, once again, I think what we're talking about, you know, yeah, they've had, you know, especially in high school, you know, let's say senior year, you've had 12 years where you've been in school. And by that 12th year, what can you do to really change their attitude? And, you know, I think it's a thing that we have to work as. And I think this is the place where it's not just up to the teachers and it's not just up to the students. It really will require a gigantic cultural shift.
Right. And I think part of the problem is that, and I know I felt this way, is that, and today I do college consulting. So I talk to students, you know, reflecting upon my own experience in college, mm-hmm. where I went there and I initially slacked off and I avoided taking difficult classes. This teacher that I was talking about that had this positive influence on me, I avoided him for like 2 years because I heard he was there's a lot of reading in that class and it's really hard and he really expects a lot from you. And taking that class changed my whole attitude about my own abilities and about education. And it made me want to be a history teacher, but I avoided that guy because I was like, I don't want to do a lot of work. And that all of that money that I'm, you know, still paying for that education certainly could have been saved or spent better somewhere else. But sure. At the time, college seemed like the 13th grade, and it seemed like it was free because it was subsidized. It was not really, but I got loans. So right. It's like, go to this place and party now and pay later. Well, when you're 18 years old, later is like another lifetime. And I think
that's absolutely right.
And I think that this is one of the things that I've tried to talk to juniors and seniors who are planning their future and planning to go to college today is like, whoever winds up getting the bill for this experience, it's a lot of money, and you should really think carefully about what you want to do and why. And when you finish 12th grade, you're not a freshman in college. That's a time where you can make a decision. But I think the same problem that I'm describing with freshmen in college, that attitude towards education, that's the societal attitude towards education as well, because it is subsidized. You know, most people are not paying they're not dropping off a check to the teacher. And like, mm-hmm. one of the things that has kept me, you know, working very hard, going above and beyond, is that the people that I work for have to hand me a check. You know, they have to say, okay, good job. Here's a check. And I think that when you start putting all of these degrees of separation between the service provider and the payer, and of course, there's no way not to fund the public education system. So again, you have the incentive problem. But for most people, the reason why students aren't invested, the reason certainly why parents aren't invested until a bad report card comes home, and I hate to admit it, but I know when quarters in high school end, and I used to look forward to that because that's when I'd start getting phone calls. Billy's got a D, you know, put out this fire. And you know, I realize that that's not the way a teacher evaluates a student's intellectual ability with one of five letters. It's not the end all be all, even though parents seem to think it is. But their ears usually don't perk up until that happens. That's when their involvement in the student's education, in their own child's education, really gets more intense, and they see it as the school's responsibility because, hey, I pay property taxes and I just want to believe that they go to this place every day and they're learning stuff. I think that people don't have much of an investment in education because it's made to look like it's free, or there's at least this separation between the payer and the service provider.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's probably some truth in that. I mean, I think you and I probably differ in a certain way. I'm not an advocate for eliminating public education, for a myriad of reasons, which I think would be a whole nother podcast.
Right.
But, you know, I do think that it's true. It's interesting. I took a survey once two things. One is when I taught at community college, it was a very different experience because most of the students that I taught there were older adults who had not gone to college after they graduated high school for whatever reasons. You know, they had to get a job to support their family. They couldn't afford to go to college. A whole bunch of reasons that students or that kids don't go to college. And when they come back at 35 years old, they were some of my best students because they were paying for their education. Even if they were getting loans, they sort of realized the value of, you know, they realized that, yes, I'm taking out a loan for this education, but I'm going to have to pay this back. And so they always came ready to learn, ready to prepare, because they weren't wasting their time trying to make friends or figuring out how they could sneak, you know, drink beer for the first time or any of those things. You know, most of them were working a full-time job and coming back and really wanting to get a college education. And so those students were always a lot of, you know, really exciting to teach, mm-hmm. Because of that. You know, they kind of had that sort of real world experience. And I, you know, when I took a survey once in an undergraduate course, and I just asked them one day, I said, so why did you guys come to college? And there was a surprising amount of students who said either I want to get a good job or, and this was the really funny one was, I don't want my parents to kick me out of the house. And they said, if I didn't go to college, I was going to get kicked out of the house. Mm. And so what's happened now in a certain sense with higher education is it's become this thing that you're just expected to do. And you know, I don't think that's fair. You know, I don't think everyone's meant to go to college. And I don't, even though I teach in higher education and I think there's a value in higher education, I also don't think it's for everybody. And it doesn't devalue I don't want to devalue the people who don't go to college. In fact, you know, a lot of my family, don't have college, you know, just have high school degrees and they're smart and they're intelligent and they're very good at what they do. College just wasn't for them.
Yeah.
And I think that's fine. But you know, I think that what is interesting, especially when you're talking about these 18-year-old kids, 19-year-old kids are going to higher education. You're right. They're not footing the bill. They're not, you know, they're not even, you know, even if they're not taking out loans and their parents are paying for it, it still doesn't come back to them thinking, okay, this is costing me money to be here. And every time I don't go to class, it's like throwing $100 down, you know, down the toilet. Or every time I fail a class, that's like throwing money away. Mm. So, you know, I think there is some truth in that and them in our society and our students sort of understanding what the cost of education is. And if we change our mindset from, include into our mindset that you go to school to learn and not just get a job, and that there is an intrinsic value in knowledge, you know, that then that's something that's worth investing in. I don't know. I'm rambling a little bit now.
No, but I think it's a good point that there is this societal pressure that translates, unfortunately, as it so often does, into a parental pressure that's inflicted on children, that college is an expectation. In a way, college almost becomes forced. For so many people, I mean, it is unacceptable. Any other decision besides the 13th grade, being a freshman in college, is unacceptable.
Right.
And, you know, if it's not college, it's the military, and that's often a forced decision in some families as well. And, you know, there was something that you wrote in this blog, and when I read it, even though I disagreed with the general idea, I read this line and I was like, bingo. And it's, you in the last paragraph, you're talking about higher education there, and you say this is the first time students are really given free will to go to class, to do their homework, and to learn. Well, you're encountering these kids when they're 18 years old, and this is the first time that they've been given freedom. So that means that their entire educational experience that comes before their freshman year in college was forced. And force ruins everything. In all aspects of our life, nothing is fun and exciting when it is forced on us. Mm-hmm. I look at so much of what I've been involved in with tutoring, and I've seen the work that kids are being forced to do, and I observe the brain dead busy work, and how, especially like in middle school, these kids are just these worksheet robots. And mm-hmm. and they're told, you know, throughout this entire experience, they're told that this is education, this is enlightenment, when really all they're being prepared for is like a successful trip to the DMV, you know, like fill out this paperwork.
Yeah.
And if you look at what is imposed on people while they're being told, or while that is all being misrepresented as education and enlightenment, I mean, what would you expect? I mean, you're talking about music, which someone pursues because they clearly have a passion for that, but they're stuck with so many of these bad habits. I couldn't imagine what it's like to be teaching, you know, English or accounting at the higher education level. That just must be like pulling teeth.
In certain ways it is. And I think, you know, there definitely is. It's easy for teachers and parents to sort of turn learning into a drone situation. You know what I mean? Or you know, it's just like this cloning tool that we are going to repeat over and over and over again. And, you know, there are certainly certain skills that I think drills can really help for that. You know, fundamental skills that you just have to practice over and over again. But I think the biggest thing that I see fault in with teachers, with parents, with everyone, when they're trying to teach someone something, is helping them connect it to a bigger picture. And why does this matter? And it's interesting, you know, because I'm a composer, I teach a lot of private students composition, which is really the art of creating something. And I tell them, look, you won't get it right now. But the sociology class that you're taking, the math class that you're taking, the history class that you're taking, all of those things that have nothing to do on the surface with what you're doing as a composer will influence everything you do as a composer. You know, those classes that I took in chemistry and sociology, I mean, because they impact you as a human being. And, you know, if you have a bigger world view than just a tiny sliver of one thing, you will be a better person, which will make you better at what you do, and more rewarding and more creative and more successful. In a certain sense, I think that's the other downside to the way we teach, is that our education is so focused on singular things. And especially higher education, when you go to get a degree in one thing, that it's not being connected that all of these things are important. You know, we're not just trying to fill up hours in your day. You know, you need to learn about history, sociology, math. All of those things affect who you are as a human being, and that's important.
I think that there are a lot of things that are presented to young people in, you know, primary and secondary education that are important, you know, some of it just to survival, you know, being able to do basic math and being able to read and write. There's an educational critic. I don't know if you're familiar with his work. He was a public school teacher for 30 years. His name was Jonathan Taylor Gatto. He says these reading skills and these basic writing skills and these functional math skills is like 80 contact hours of teaching. What people jettison as far as all of the information that's packed into their heads during these 12 years, a lot more is let go than is retained. And I think that while there is value in a lot of what could be presented to a young person in this whole school process, there is also a lot that has no value, and kids know that, and kids can see that. And I think that the lack of freedom, the lack of choice, the lack of the, you know, the ability to opt out or to say no, or to make their own decisions, to be self-directed as learners, that's very palpable. By the time, you know, most of these kids are in middle school. And, you know, my whole, catchphrase here with this show that school sucks. I mean, yeah, I've heard so many kids say that when I ask them to describe their feelings about what they're put through. But, you know, I've spent the last 2 months working with some very, very young kids who are like, you know, 6, 7, 8 years old, and they, if they were in the public school system or they were in some kind of institutionalized public or private education setting, it was for a very short period of time. So we can see, and especially in even younger kids, like 3, 4 years old, where they're always asking why, they're always curious, they're being scientists, they want to investigate. We see the curiosity, we see the creativity, we see the individuality, the hope, the optimism. When these kids show up in your classroom, all that stuff is gone. And, you know, there might be numerous factors that contribute to that, but I think that school sucks a lot of these innate attributes out of us just through, you know, being this processing plant, being this repetitive, mundane environment that these kids, are forced to go through. And sure, my criticism, you know, or the reason why I'm against having a public system, even though I think that that scares a lot of people. And I'm telling you, if we lived in a society where computers were made by the government and subsidized by the government, and I started saying, boy, you know, you should really turn computers over to the free market, people would say, well, that would never work. Who would know? People would be making all kinds of different software that's not compatible with each other, and they'd be too expensive and nobody could afford them. But we see that when that was left to market forces, it had the exact opposite of education. The cost shot down and the quality shot up. Education, public education has had the opposite trajectory in both respects. So I think that there are alternatives. And when I talk about the problems that I have with school and try to expose it in a lot of ways as unjust, people kind of steer around the unjust argument when it comes to the compulsion, both in attendance and funding. And they say, well, what would you put in your place? What's your alternative? Talk to me like the politicians do, you know, lie to me, pretend you have a solution. And I think that that requires at that point a bit of humility to say, I don't know how everything would work because I don't know everybody who needs to be educated. I don't know their strengths. I don't know their needs. I don't know their socioeconomic backgrounds. I don't know their physical and emotional health. So I can't design a one size fits all system. And the solution or the alternative to the government education system might need to be 10,000 different things. And I think that that's a goal that is worth pursuing, or at the very least starting some dialogue about, because I think if, you know, I mean, saying you live in a free society, but leaving the education and the mind shaping of young people up to the government, that's a little inconsistent to me, you know? And I think that in a lot of societies that were more ostensibly totalitarian, like in Cuba, Germany, the Soviet Union, the first thing that those people did was grab control of the education system. They knew they needed that. They knew they needed to start pounding stuff into the minds of these kids. And I think a lot of the horrors that we're dealing with in this country, you know, for everything from the healthcare situation to foreign policy, it has its roots in the lack of education.
Yeah. You know, I think, one thing that you hit on that I think is true is that I don't think there is a one size fits all type of education for everybody. And you're absolutely right. I think we do need to look at a more diverse, way of providing people with with learning opportunities. You know, one thing that I have to say I really love about higher education is this thing they call academic freedom, in the sense that all I'm told whenever I take on a new class, I'm given the course description and the sort of the skill sets that the students need to know by the time they get to the end of my class. Now, how I choose to teach it, what textbooks I choose to use, all of those things are up to me. I have academic freedom. I've never worked in the public school system, in the K through 12 public school system, so I don't have that experience. But, you know, it seems to me that academic freedom isn't there. There's a certain textbook everyone has to use. And I think, you know, there's reasons for that. You know, in college with a textbook, you know, the students buy the textbook. In high school, junior high, well, the school buys the textbook. And so you can't necessarily have that same kind of freedom. But having that academic freedom, actually, I do think makes a huge difference in the way we educate people. And just saying, look, by the time they're done with sixth grade, here are the skill sets they need to move on. And then however you want them to learn those skill sets, that's up to you. You're the teacher. You're the expert in that area. I think the other one of the other things, once again, or a problem with our K through 12 system is that, you know, look, we don't really have the courage to hold students back. You know, and saying, you know, in higher education, if a student fails my class, I have no problem failing them and telling them that they have to retake my class next year. You know, if this is your major, you don't understand this material, and I'm not going to let you move on to the next semester, because if you do move on to the next semester, you're just going to fail that semester because you don't understand the previous semester. And in K through 12 education, there seems to be this fear of saying, you know, this student is unprepared to move on to eighth grade, and holding them back because of all sorts of, you know, oh, they're going to be a year older than everyone, and how is that going to feel, blah, 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 blah. And so once again, this comes back to our society and cultural outlook, is that, you know, my taxes pay for education. So I should just, since I'm paying taxes for this education, you should just move me through the grade system. And it's even, I see it in college, however, I have more freedom to do this, but, you know, in college, it's like, well, we're paying our tuition to go here. You know, I don't understand why you're not letting me make up all the homework that I didn't turn in.
Well, I think when you're an adult, because I'm kind of worried about stepping back into this, the carrots and sticks discussion when it comes to grades. When you're an adult, the people you're dealing with, first of all, if people are not intrinsically motivated and there because they have a genuine passion, then all bets are off. All that the carrots and sticks system does is make people feel defective and bad about themselves. And I don't think that that's something that really, if you're interested in the self-esteem and the well-being of children, that their measurements of their intellectual ability should be left up to strangers, especially if it's something that they have no interest in. And I deal with this with parents all the time. It's like, well, you know, if George can't get his chemistry grade up, he won't be playing football. And I'm like, wow, what a brilliant parenting strategy. And what a strategy for the school, too. If the kid can't do well at something he's not interested in and hates, we'll take away the thing that he's good at and he likes. And that's sure. Just the most backward thing to me. Now, when you're talking about higher education, you're dealing with adults. So adults should be accountable for their actions. That's the system that they agree to voluntarily. Like, I'm going to grade you and you need to do this. That's semi-contractual. But that's the lower grades or secondary or primary education. That's not the dynamic that we're dealing with. So the whole carrots and sticks system there is really just about making people feel bad and trying to get temporary compliance. So people say, oh, punishments and rewards are so great because they work. But they only work in the short term to get temporary compliance. And when you're getting temporary compliance, you're not inspiring people to want to learn, to want to do better. So I'm against the whole grades thing. Higher education, if people say, all right, well, this is the college policy, this is this teacher's policy, and I'm an adult and I sign my name here and say I'm into that. Yeah, I got no problem with that. But at every lower level, that is imposed on people, and it just winds up stripping them of true motivation and making them feel bad about themselves or good about themselves for shallow reasons.
You know, I agree with that in a certain sense. I think that, I'm not necessarily a big fan of the grade thing either. And I think it does change in higher education. Like you said, there is sort of a contractual agreement and they're adults and they make those adult decisions. And I don't think that grades are a real evaluator for the student's ability either, because, you know, grades, we all know that grades aren't just determinant on how much that student knows about that subject. It's, do they show up to class? Do they turn in their homework? Do they do well on their tests? There's so many things that go into factoring that grade that have nothing to do with, does the student know the material? It's interesting. I am a product of elementary school. I went to a Montessori school from first grade to fifth grade. Oh, actually, even kindergarten up to fifth grade was Montessori. And in Montessori, you know, there are no grades. There's a curriculum in a sense, but you have the freedom to explore that curriculum. And it was a very beneficial thing for me. And it was what inspired my passion for learning. That and my parents. You know, my parents have always been, you know, and it's not like my parents were elitist billionaires. I mean, my mother was a lawyer, but my dad was a contractor plumber for a long time. And so, you know, there was blue collar and white collar in my family. And but they always encouraged me to learn. And being in that Montessori experience encouraged me to explore the things that I had an interest in. So when I was in third grade, for whatever reason, I fell in love with the subject of botany. And so my teacher said, well, go ahead and write a report on botany. Yeah, that sounds great. And I tell you what, we'll set up a field trip to the botanical gardens. You and four other students can go visit the botanical gardens. And so it was a really positive learning experience that wasn't based on my grade. Now, there were still a set of things that I was expected to know before you were done with your education there. But having that freedom within it's almost like a structured freedom. You know what I mean?
But what you're saying there is botany was just the reward, right? Like, so I get what you're saying, and I agree. And I think that whoever that teacher, I mean, I'll make the assumption that whoever that teacher was certainly on the right track, but still you're stuck in this environment where the thing you want to do becomes the reward for trudging through the things that are imposed on you, some of which might be important and some of them might be, essential functional skills and some of them might not, but it still, you know, takes that control away from the learner. So I get what you're saying and I kind of agree that the teacher might have been like on the right track, but I still kind of have a little problem with that.
So actually, I disagree, because it wasn't like they were trying to get me to do botany. I came to them and said, I want to learn more about botany. And she just encouraged that. And it wasn't, you have to do this. And it wasn't, if you don't do this, we're not going to let you do that. It was, you want to know about botany? Well, let me point you to some aspects and tell you what, we're going to make a way for, well, if you want to do this, then let's set up something where you can go to the botanical garden and meet with a botanist there and talk to them about flowers. So it wasn't a carrot sticks thing in that situation.
Okay. It sounded like it had an element of that, because, you know, I always think about I watch these parents with these kids, and they're like, if you eat six bites of this, you can have one of these. Right. But right. If you don't eat six bites of that, you can't have one of these. So it's like kind of dangling a reward, but actually it's functioning as a punishment. Like, there is ice cream right over there. I could easily give it to you. But first, I want to watch you do something you don't want to do.
Sure.
So, and, you know, it's like,
I have two daughters under the age of two. And so, I mean, we actually made a real conscious decision that we don't do that. You know, we don't go, well, if you want this, you got to do that. It's, you know, because in a certain way too, like with all, you know, all of that, it kind of becomes, you take away the, well, I mean, I think this is maybe what we're both saying. You take away the fun, you know, and you, if you say, well, if you want your ice cream, then you've got to eat, you know, your chicken. And then the, what happens is the chicken becomes a chore to get to the reward. But man, chicken can be really good.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. But, when chicken is forced, anything that's forced sucks, you know? So when chicken is forced on you, I love chicken today, but if it was forced into my mouth, you know, on a weekly basis as a child, I probably wouldn't be so crazy about it.
Yeah.
I think that there's a lot here. I think we could go a lot further if you want to come back at some point, because you did mention school reform, and I would kind of be interested in talking about that. I like to keep these shows around an hour, so I think we're just about there. But I really enjoyed the conversation, and I will put a link to your blog on my website, the show notes, and anything else you want to add?
Let me say, I'd love to be back on. You know, I think what's nice is I think you and I have some similar views. I think we also have some very different views, which I think is always what's great about these kinds of conversations. You know, for me, once again, this whole thing comes down to, I would summarize it in just saying, we have to change this cultural mindset and not to value education, but to value learning. And you know, that's what it comes down to for me. And that's what I stress as a teacher. That's what I stress as a, you know, as a parent, as a human being. I just want to encourage people to learn and, you know, and learn about the things that they're passionate about learning about. And, you know, the things that they're not passionate about learning about, well, you know, see if maybe that can work into their, you know, if they can find some relevance for them. Because you just never know. All of that stuff sort of affects who you are. But it was a lot of fun. I really appreciate you having me on here and even just taking the time to just read my brain droppings, as I call them.
Well, it was my pleasure, and thank you for your time, and hopefully we can talk again in the future.
I'd love that. Take care.
All right, bye. And I turned 21 in prison, doing life without parole. No one would steer me right, but mama tried to raise me better, but her pleading I denied. That leaves only me to blame, cause mama tried. That leaves only me to blame those.